We have
four
matters. We're getting some feedback. All right, let's see. All right, we'll begin again. We have four matters on the administrative docket for the court this afternoon. For those who are participating in the hearings, we have myself, Justice Associate Chief Justice Perry-Gary, and Justice Kadish in Carson City. Justices Silver, Pickering, and Herndon in Las Vegas, and Justice Stiglitz is participating. You're not able to see her face. It's a connectivity problem, but she is participating and may ask questions on any number of these petitions. The first petition before the court today is filed in ADKP 411. That is an administrative docket petition that seeks to conclude the work of the Indigent Defense Commission as outlined in the petition. The Indigent Defense Commission began some years ago at the direction of the Supreme Court. It successfully and admirably accomplished numerous objectives that were prescribed in the scope of work. Personally, and on behalf of my colleagues on the Supreme Court, we wish to extend our congratulations and thanks to the members of the Commission, and in particular, its chair, retired Justice Michael Cherry. His passion, enthusiasm, and dedication to the cause of indigent defense was demonstrated repeatedly throughout the work of this commission. And we're grateful to his leadership and the many accomplishments that the commission achieved during that period of time, none the least of which included revisions to the standards of practice dealing with defense counsel, the appointment of contract counsel, investigations undertaken with respect to the use of appointed counsel in rural communities, ultimately the establishment of legislation that created an Indigent Defense Commission staffed by six people, newly funded positions by the legislature in 2019. All in all, I'd say an extraordinary accomplishment for that commission and for its chair. We'd also like to extend our thanks and appreciation to Mr. John McCormick, Deputy Director of the Administrative Office of the Courts, who was and is a mainstay throughout this effort by the Indigent Defense Commission. As the petition relates, because the work has now been transferred to this executive branch commission and staff, fully staffed, the Supreme Court's commission was, in my view as Chief Justice, no longer necessary to continue. That's the opening. I wonder if there are any persons who would like to offer any comment on the petition in Administrative Docket 0411. Hearing and seeing none, do my colleagues on the bench have any questions or comments regarding this petition? All right, then the petition will stand submitted for the court's determination. The next petition on the docket is, and by the way, I should mention, although we have continued it, Administrative Docket 0571, in the matter of standardized forms related to the protection of children from abuse and neglect. This matter, with the concurrence of the chair, co-chairs, retired Justice Seda and Justice Kadish, has been continued to April 8th at 3 p.m. For those of you who might have been logging in or calling in to participate or watch the hearing on that particular petition, it has been continued to the 8th of April, excuse me, at 3 p.m. So the next public hearing is then on Administrative Docket 0572 in the matter of amendments regarding the elections to the Board of Governors and amendments regarding meetings of the Board of Governors and revisions relating to the term of Executive Secretary. This petition comes to the court by way of the State Bar of Nevada and its president, Mr. Eric Doberstein. Mr. Doberstein, I'll let you proceed with that petition if you like.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and the honorable members of the Supreme Court. I appreciate you taking these matters before you this afternoon. The first one is the, as the Chief Justice has mentioned, is 572. It's mainly a housekeeping proposal dealing with some revisions that we kind of discovered when we had this COVID issue come up in March, and it was affecting our ability to move forward with the annual meeting that we were having scheduled for July in New Orleans. And we had to submit a request to the court to make some modifications in order to go to a Zoom virtual meeting and to not have a traditional meeting that we normally would have in person. So these modifications are removing some of that language and the current practice for calling regular and special meetings of the board. The annual meetings and the rules contemplate a meeting of the entire membership at the time these rules were written. And there were fewer attorneys in the state at that time, as we all know. We also are seeking to untie some time frames for the elections to the Board of Governors, since we have moved to a more modern process of elections. These rules were originally written dealing when we all used to elect our board members through the mail, as you can recall, when you used to receive those double envelope ballots and send back and forth. And we also are asking to provide some consistency with respect to the term executive director rather than executive secretary as the rules were originally written. So to summarize, just to run down, again, as I mentioned, it was because of the cancellation of the 2020 annual meeting due to COVID pandemic. This came up. The time frames in the elections were tied directly to the date of the annual meeting. Special request was made, was going to be needed from the court to set aside the rules for conducting an annual meeting and set a date to be held virtually. The state bar's proposal calls for the creation of a consistent timing of annual elections beginning on the second Tuesday in April, concluding 14 days thereafter, as well as consistent dates for soliciting petitions and the certification of those results. We have proposed a process of conducting those elections in the Board of Governor bylaws, which were included in our petition. The proposed amendments also call for a shortened time frame for casting ballots from the current 30 days to 14 days to again reflect the online voting process that has been in place since 2010. The timeframe is consistent with other states that conduct their Board of Governor elections electronically. And if the court should adopt these amendments, we would respectfully request you to make the effective date March 15th of this year so that we may implement these procedures for this year's election so that we would have enough time to proceed forward with the election and getting everyone processed and certified and sworn in for our annual meeting this June. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to entertain such. I also have online with us Board of Governors, our president-elect, Ann Morgan, as well as one of our board governors, Andrew Craner. We also have our executive director, Kim Farmer, and our assistant executive director, Lisa Dreitzer, and our bar counsel, Dan Hoagie.
Thank you, President Doberstein. I have two questions for myself. I'll see if other members of the court have any questions, and then we'll invite some comment or questions from those who are attending the meeting, the hearing, I should say. My two questions are these. By the statistics identified in the petition itself, it concerns me that shortening the voting period from 30 days to 14 days will necessarily result in a drop-off in participation by somewhere between 25% and a third of the state bar members who vote on Board of Governors. I'm not sure I see a compelling reason to reduce the length of the voting period from 30 days to 14 days, and would invite comment on that. And my second question has to do with item 4.6 on page 22 of Exhibit B, which is the description of the terms of commencement of the Board of Governors. That, to me, seems considerably ambiguous. If it commences on the date of the oath of office, then that means a new board member could commence anywhere between the time that election concludes up to July 31st, and then perhaps the next year might be a year and 2 month period of service. So my question is, why not set, as in most instances we do, and I understand you're trying to get away from the annual meeting connection, but why not set a term, definite term, a commencement date and conclusion date, and stick with it? Those are my two comments.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'll address the 4.6 one right off the bat for you, and I think I'll ask Ms. Farmer to address the voting, since she's pretty well up on the election results that we receive over the years and how they came in and what the pattern has been showing. With respect to the 4.6 commencement, I would probably tend to agree with you. I would think that that makes reasonable sense. Perhaps it could be within a certain number of days after the election. I think the original thought was, if you recall, traditionally, we all would be elected, and then the first Board of Governor meetings would be the annual meeting that takes place at our annual meeting, and the new members would show up at the annual meeting, and they would be sworn in by one of you all from the Supreme Court. So, and then the traditional thought was always to have the annual meeting prior to July 31st, and those dates would fluctuate based upon the locale that would be selected for the annual meeting, as well as rates or whatever is scheduled for the June and July time period. So I would probably support some type of modification as well, Your Honor, to have something within a certain number of days, perhaps after they're sworn in. With respect to the voting. I believe Ms. Farmer can weigh in and tell you as to what she would see once the ballots went out, that there would be a large influx right off the bat, and how few would come in at the tail end. So I'll let Ms. Farmer address that.
Good afternoon, Justice, Chief Justice Hardesty, Justices. This is Kim Farmer, Executive Director of the State Bar of Nevada. The thought process with the shortened time frame really deals with the fact that we get the most votes at the first part of the voting period. And we found that any time we send a reminder, we'll get a few more votes. And at the very deadline we put voting ends on such and such date, we'll get another wave of votes coming in, whatever that deadline is. The Board of Governors did not think that this would limit the opportunity for members who want to vote in the election. They really thought it was more to allow conclusion of the elections so that those elected to the board can plan moving forward for the next board meeting. The reality is whenever we send a reminder out, we'll get a couple votes, but there is the process where people aren't that interested as the vote opens and there's complacency. So that's why we thought we would not see a problem or reduction in involvement with cutting down the voting period from the 30-day period that's currently available.
All right. Do any of my colleagues on the court have any questions for Mr. Doberstein or Ms. Farmer regarding this administrative docket petition? Are there any members or persons participating in the hearing that would like to be heard on this petition? All right, hearing and seeing none, Mr. Doberstein, the court will take under submission ADKT 0572, and we thank you, Ms. Farmer, and the Board of Governors and staff for preparing that proposal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The next petition is Administrative Docket Petition 0573. In the matter of amendments to Supreme Court Rule 22 through Supreme Court Rule 228 regarding Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility. This also comes to the court by the Board of Governors and President Doberstein. President Doberstein, please proceed.
Thank you again, Chief and Justices. Again, this is another petition addressing some language to clean up and to be more consistent with some of the other rules that are already codified in the Supreme Court. The proposed amendments remove much of the process language from the court rules and would require the Board of Governors to establish procedures necessary to carry out the Standing Committee's functions and remove some procedural language from the rules. The main one is the lifetime limits. We were making this proposal to remove the lifetime and restrict it to a lifetime of 12 years is the main change. And then you'll see there's some other language that we have removed that is not applicable any longer or should be shortened and can be more concise with respect to that. In the 225 sub 7E regarding the prohibition on acting upon request, a situation in litigation or threat litigation, as this language is vague and overbroad. That's why we went ahead and tried to address that. Any opinion request could potentially involve an issue that is pending in litigation or has the potential for litigation in some court, regardless of whether the requestor is directly involved or even aware of the matter. We also have Brett Candid, who's the chair of the Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility, also online, as well as the rest of the Board of Governors and staff of the State Bar that I previously mentioned, that can address any further questions or details if you would like to have addressed.
I have just one question, and I wanted to be clear about the schedule attached as Exhibit C. As I understand it, based upon the proposal for lifetime term limits, Mr. Freer, Mr. Garrett, and Mr. Hemanowski would term out September 2022. Is that correct?
I believe so, but perhaps Ms. Farmer can just verify that for me.
Chief Justice Hardesty, that is correct. They would term out the end of their current term, okay. September 2022.
All right. Do any of my colleagues on the court have any questions regarding the proposals relating to the Standing Committee?
Chief Justice Hardesty, this is Justice Pickering, and I have a question with respect to subsection 7.
Okay.
And my question is in Rule 225. I think it's ambiguous because it's not clear to me reading it whether the identity of the formal advisory opinion requestor is confidential prior to public comment or publication, but not thereafter. And I think the intent is that the requester's identity remain confidential even after the order or opinion is created. Is that right?
I would believe that's the intent. Perhaps Mr. Kent can probably give you further clarification from that.
If that's the intent, I have a simple edit, which would be just to put a colon after confidence and then a little A and then a semicolon after requester and a little B ahead of committee work. And that would leave the phrase prior to public comment or publication just attached to the committee work product.
Mr. Kent, do you have a response?
Yes, may it please the court, Brett Kent, for the record, on behalf of the Standing Committee. Thank you for consideration of the petition, and certainly that proposed amendment would be would make sense, and I think would better reflect the intent.
Okay. Any other questions by the justices of Mr. Kent or Mr. Doberstein or others regarding this petition? All right. Are there any persons who would like to offer any comments or testimony to the court on this petition? Very well. I'd like to extend my and the court's sincere appreciation and thanks to Mr. Kent and the members of his committee for the extraordinary work and important work that they do on this committee. It is work that is not always seen, but it is very important and critical, I think, to the membership of our profession. And we appreciate your dedication and the time you spend dealing with these ethical issues and questions. I also appreciate your efforts and those of Mr. Coffin and Ms. Dreitzer for bringing forward these suggestions. I think they clear up and clean up, as suggested, some of the language in the rules, and we appreciate your initiation of these changes. Thank you very much for your continued service. We greatly appreciate it. This matter will stand submitted then for the court's decision. And that brings us then to administrative docket petition number 0574 regarding an amendment to the rule of professional conduct 1.15 to allow remittance of unclaimed or unidentified property in a lawyer's client trust account to the Nevada Bar Foundation. Mr. Doverstein.
Thank you again, Your Honor, as well as the other justices. This is the suggestion and the petition to the court to address the unclaimed funds and what we thought would be a good solution and an assistance to our members that have accumulated or have funds that they can't seem to find their clients or return it. And instead of going back to the general coffers of the state, this would probably make more sense and more use to have it directed into something that would benefit more along the lines of our mission as lawyers. The court rules do not suggest, as you're aware, of any avenue on how to dispose of funds when lawyers end up with being in possession of funds that they cannot remit back to the client. Mergers and dissolutions of law firms, or when clients have moved on and not stayed in contact with the particular attorney, or I've had money returned through the mail and have not had any ability to track down clients myself over the years when funds would come in unexpectedly. So the because of that, bar counsel is unable to advise lawyers when they do call into bar counsel's office as to what and how the funds should be directed. And this becomes complicated because NRS 120A-500-6F prohibits client trust funds from being directed to the Secretary of State's Unclaimed Property Division. And this proposal would create a mechanism for lawyers after 5 years of receipt and after making reasonable attempts to locate and distribute funds to the owner and to remit those unclaimed and unidentified client funds to the Nevada Bar Foundation. There are other states that have adopted similar rule amendments, and as several states use these funds to support access to justice initiatives. Unlike other states that put on the burden upon holding the unclaimed funds, this proposal allows that the funds that would end up in the foundation would be clean and that they would be coming from the attorney after he has done his due diligence in trying to track down the owner of these funds, and after a period of time that he has been unable to do that, then he can turn over those funds to the foundation, and the foundation would not have to worry about the how they distribute those funds or grant those funds out or have any waiting period. This Nevada Bar Foundation typically grants all available dollars and maximizes the funding available in a given year to support the statewide pro bono programs. We do not have any estimate on how many attorneys may be holding unclaimed or unidentified funds, mostly because they are typically reluctant, as you can imagine, to tell the state bar this predicament that they are in. However, we have learned from other states while researching this and looking into this, states like Pennsylvania, Arkansas, Colorado, Illinois, that when the program was introduced And when reminders are sent out to licensed attorneys, remittances are flow from there and are submitted to the foundation. So, for example, we've actually found in the Illinois that they received $350,000 in 2019 when their members were advised of this, and then they submitted another $110,000 in 2020. So we think this is a great use of the funds. I think it solves a lot of dilemmas that lawyers have, especially when they're winding down the businesses and trying to figure out what to do with funds that are in their trust account. And time period, we are also asking in this ADKT that the retention period also be consistent in RPC 1.15 to be amended from the 7 years to the 5 years to make it consistent with Supreme Court Rule 78. So if you have any questions or comments, we also have staff and bar counsel and myself here to address any more details or suggestions that you may have.
Do my colleagues on the court have any questions of Mr. Doberstein or the staff regarding this petition?
I do, Chief. This is Justice Herndon, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Mr. Doberstein, I just had a quick question. I don't have any great quarrel with the recommendation. I think it's a very worthy cause. In regard to the foundation, I was curious, however, about the debate that may have gone on about that third option, which is to give the money into the Nevada Client Security Fund. It seems like if it's client funds that have in some way been abandoned, it's more of a one-to-one match to move them to that fund to help clients whose funds have been taken, essentially. I think they're both worthy causes. I just didn't know how you all settled upon the one option.
I'll let Mr. Hoagie address that, but I think the thinking, at least from my perspective, was that, yeah, it's a one-for-one match, thinking that you'll get more bang out of your buck if it goes to the Nevada Bar Foundation and would be more consistent with the source of where it came from. And I think you also have this conflict of the NRS statute. So, Mr. Hoagie?
Yeah, thank you, Justice Herndon. I think, you know, that was a big issue going back and forth. I think those were the two forerunners, I guess, in looking at all the options. I think ultimately we felt like, well, I know the board had discussed this, but as staff too, and presenting this to the board, we felt like the Client Security Fund, and the way they do it is that, you know, they will actually investigate a case. They'll go through a specific case, look at a specific client, and then reimburse there. And, you know, if a person has just disappeared, let's say a client, the attorney's done 5 years of due diligence, has really tried their best to find that client, and they can't find that client. You know, we just felt like it's very rare, or it would be very difficult for that client to come forward at a later time. And so, you know, the likelihood of actually getting that money back to that original client would be small. And then it goes to a lot of the redemption period discussion as well. You know, should there be a redemption period? And ultimately, the logistics for that redemption period, because you're talking about 5 years, so you're going to make it difficult for the Client Security Fund people to investigate that matter because it's, you know, 5 years old, and then it's just complex administratively to get that reimbursed, and so you put that money into there, and then they would ask, well, what, you know, why don't we have a redemption period in the first place, you know, there's just a lot of weighing. I think it was very close. I don't think one is necessarily in leaps and bounds ahead of the other, but ultimately felt like the Bar Foundation was just helping access to justice. It just had a slight edge.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Any other questions by members of the court about this particular petition? All right, hearing none, are there any comments from the public regarding the this petition? Okay, seeing none.
There's no one in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Sorry, there's no one in Las Vegas, I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you. Then evidently there's no further comment on this petition. Mr. Doberstein and Administrative Docket Number 0574 will also stand submitted. For those of you who may be watching this proceeding and know that Administrative Docket 0575, a petition to alter the rules governing the alternative dispute resolution, short trial rules, and NRCP 68 to increase the rates of compensation for attorneys, arbitrators, mediators, and judges pro tem, following a meeting, joint meeting of the Board of Governors and the Supreme Court, the Board of Governors elected to withdraw that petition for now, and that will be either refiled and then rescheduled when and if the Board of Governors is prepared to present it. So with that, I believe we have concluded our public hearings for today, and the court will stand in recess until tomorrow. As administrative docket. Thank you very much, Mr. Doberstein, Ms. Morgan, and the board and the staff. We really appreciate your proactive approach to clearing up these matters and rendering them more efficient. Thank you.